Good morning, friends. Hello, hello. Hi. Welcome to the January meeting of the First Friday Breakfast Club. I'm doing my best impression of Jonathan and Byron this morning. Byron was under the weather and Jonathan is in Phoenix. Damn him. And so we're all together this morning and excited for some fellowship and some conversation from Dr. Lauren Olson. We are light on announcements this morning. So with Rick Miller going first and then others going after him, we could have a little open mic time if people want to share what's going on before Rick comes. Before Rick comes up, Jim Sterba talked about Primetimers, does still have their movie night coming up and does still have their potluck coming up. But obviously with COVID being ascendant again with the Omicron virus, that some of the activities that Primetimers normally do have kind of been, you know, shifted around and stuff. So if you're interested in seeing what Primetimers is up to, Jim Sterba is your man in the rainbow mask. Is there anybody here for the first time this morning? Stand up and introduce yourself if you wish to. It'd be great.
Dave Phelps.
Welcome, Dave. Very good. And I understand a couple of guys came from Fairfield this morning. So shout out. We've seen you before. Yes. Yay. You win the award for longest journey by a long shot. And John Clayton sometimes has that honor from Grinnell in the mornings, but I don't see him this morning. But okay. So if you have announcements, wait until after Rick Miller. Otherwise, I will turn it over to Rick momentarily here.
It was really not my intention to do a presentation here. I was just hoping to get a presentation for the First Friday Breakfast Club board. But what's happening is Polk County has a gallery. Maybe many of you do not know that, but several years ago, I curated a show called Evolution of the Revolution, 50 years since Stonewall. And I think some of you actually got to that. So you kind of know of the gallery. What we're promoting right now and what I'm especially interested in is a special show coming from Helena, Montana called Speaking Volumes, Transforming Hate. It is a touring show and it's actually started with a white supremacist in Idaho who decided he was not going to do that anymore. And he was the leader of the movement. So he gave over 4,000 different documents, books, brochures, and so on to this museum. And they have turned those into stories in which artists have taken these brochures, books, and so on, and have transformed them into some story about minority rights. It's not just about Black lives or Indigenous people. It's about a lot of people that we know today are discriminated against. So the lesbian who is curating the show made sure that LGBT was included too. So I'm just going to ask the board if they will consider doing a sponsorship. So far, the Des Moines Pride Center is involved and they are giving a $500 sponsorship of this. We've raised, I think, $7,500 so far and our goal is $12,000 to get it here. Thank you.
When is it?
It is in May and June of this year. We put it off for over a year because of the pandemic.
All righty. And I think I lost. I think Gary, where'd you go, Gary? There you are, Gary. I think you're introducing Dr. Olson this morning, unless there are other announcements from other folks. Well, we'll make up time in the air then and give Dr. Olson more time to chat with us. So Gary is handling the introduction this morning and I will let Gary take it away. Thank you, Gary.
Good morning, everyone. By now you've had an opportunity to read Dr. Olson's biography that was included in the announcement for this meeting. So I'm not gonna repeat what's already been done. You know that he's been a psychiatrist that has been in practice for a long time here in Des Moines. You know that he's been a member of the First Friday Breakfast Club for a long time. You know him from speaking to the First Friday Breakfast Club previously, when his first book, finally out, Letting Go of Living Straight, a psychiatrist's own story. You know, he has a second book that is soon to be released, No More Neckties, a memoir and essays. But did you know that Dr. Olson was also instrumental in getting Prime Timers started here in Des Moines? Did you know that he was involved with Prime Timers worldwide? Did you know that Prime Timers is a worldwide organization? He's been involved in quite a wide range of activities here in Des Moines. Did you know that Dr. Olson also makes a great dinner companion when you're on a train trip to Chicago? In fact, I had dinner with Dr. Olson last night with Prime Timers and learned that, you know, older men with large stomachs are seen as attractive by many younger men. I'm going to have to change my profile on Adam for Adam. It's my pleasure to introduce again to First Friday Breakfast Club, doctor, author, and for me, a great humorist, Dr. Olson.
Well, thank you, Gary, and also David for helping me out with slides and stuff that I'm not very good at. And I appreciate the opportunity to come speak to the group again, and also the fact that so many of you got up and I got out of bed this morning. I was expecting that we'd have one table. We talked, Dave and I talked about it beforehand. A couple years ago, my older daughter told me this story about Ben, who's my oldest grandchild. And he at the time was about 13. And they were on the way to hockey practice and she was transporting him. And he says, Mom, I don't think I'm through puberty yet. I haven't had a wet dream. And it was, he sort of talked to her about that as if he was talking about his next hockey practice. You know, it was just a casual comment that he made. And then I want you to contrast that with another situation I had. When I closed my office here in Des Moines, I'd seen this woman for 25 years for a depressive disorder. And we did some psychotherapy and stuff at first. But then at the end of that time, it was mostly for medication management. But I'd seen her for that long a period of time. And at the final session, after 25 years, we were set to do some termination. She came into my office and she said, Dr. Olson, I read your book. She was talking about finally out. You told me more than you needed to. Why did you do that? And so I went through the sort of, I needed to be authentic. I needed to tell people who I really was. And then we went through the process of saying goodbye and stuff. She got up and walked to the door with her hand on the doorknob. She said to me, I've always thought I was a lesbian. So after 25 years, after hearing my story, was she comfortable in finally telling me that that was her biggest challenge. So I kind of wonder, are you more like Ben, my grandson? Or are you more like my lesbian patient who had difficulty dealing with this? And I also wonder, were you like me, always a good boy and did all of the right stuff? I always did what was expected of me. I always hated it, but I didn't feel like I had much choice. So I actually changed, if I could have the next slide, the title of this to Fitting in is not belonging. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. I thought the other title sounded too much like Sally Field's acceptance speech for her Academy Award. The first words in this new book are, growing up, I was always a good boy, and I'm sick of it. I did it because I wanted to fit in. And I thought that's what I had to do. I never really felt like I belonged. I was popular. I was active in a lot of things. I played sports. I did all the right things, but somehow I just never felt like I was a part of the group. But in order to connect with other people, we have to allow ourselves to be seen and to be seen deeply. And I didn't think I could risk it. So last time Bishop Johnson talked about the seven veils, and he talked about how, the story is that the woman is standing there dancing and she takes off one after another and finally takes off the last and standing naked before the group. And writing a memoir is a little like that. You know, I feel a little nervous about this coming out, a book. It's very personal. So I think about that. And when I started writing it, someone said to me, you have to write the most difficult chapter first, because if you can't write the most difficult chapter, you can't write your memoir. And I wrote that chapter 10 years ago. And it wasn't until I guess I got old that I felt I could talk about it, because it's really like removing the last veil. Now, many of you know that Doug and I have been together for 35 years, and many of you also know that we went through 15 years ago a very dark time in our relationship, and we weren't even sure that it could last. And that was what the hardest time in our relationship was. And I think I couldn't really write it until I felt secure that our relationship was back on board. And the reason that we got into trouble in our relationship is because we weren't talking about the hard stuff. And that's the stuff we all need to talk about. In writing a memoir, it's not only that people are that you're opening yourself to criticism about your writing, but you're also opening yourself to criticism about the way you lived your life. And that part of it is the part that's a bit frightening for me. So you may think that I say too much about, like my patient said. But Helen Mirren, when she was interviewed, the interviewer said, well, what advice would you as an older woman give your self as a younger woman? And Helen Mirren's response was, I'd learn to say fuck off more. And so, you know, I'm old now, I'm almost 79, and I don't need your approval. I don't need it anymore. And if I tell you too much, fuck off. Because if I'm known at all in this world, I want to be known as myself. And there's a long part of my life where I didn't feel like that was the case. So what I'm going to talk about today is why I like the word queer, the intersectionality of queer and disabled, and fitting in is not belonging. Well, Brandon, who's the second son in this story, my older daughter's grandson, he was probably in the fifth grade. And he said to me one day, he said, Grandpa, did you know that it takes one egg and one sperm to make a baby? And I said, yeah, I did. I kind of was amused by it. And then he said, and if you have a different sperm and a different egg, you have an entirely different baby. And I assured him, yes, I had known that. So after our initial discussion about sperm and eggs, my grandson asked me, what's the Q in LGBTQ, Grandpa? Some people say that it means queer, but some kids don't like that very much because it's not a very nice word. I hesitated. Well, when I was your age, queer definitely wasn't a nice word, but I've come to like it. I explained that the word queer has gained some acceptance as a catch-all term for a wide variety of sexual and gender expressions. I also wanted my grandson to know that figuring out one's sexual orientation or gender identity is a process that can occur over a long period of time. I continued, the cue also means questioning, because some people haven't quite figured out their sexuality. No doubt he will ask sometime how grandpa could have been straight when he married his grandmother, and now he's gay and married to a man. The final question my grandson asked was, but what about the I in LGBTQI, grandpa? I know it means intersex, but I don't know that what that is. I've seen boys' penises, and I've seen girls, and then he hesitated, things. It should be pretty obvious that a new baby is either a boy or a girl. So our lexicon has expanded considerably now. We have terms like non-binary, genderqueer, heteroflexible, and the New York Times survey did a survey on how people self-labeled their orientation or gender, and they came up with 116 different labels that people use to identify themselves. And now we're confronted with the process of relearning everyone's pronouns, which is going to be a hard thing for some of us to get used to. Could I have the next one, David? This is a thing that I think, I don't know how many of you are familiar with it. This is in public domain, so if you ever want to use it to talk about, it's talks about gender and sexual orientation. And basically, our identity is in our brain, our attractions are in our heart, our sex is in our genitalia, and the outside is how we express all of that. And if I could have the next one, David. So orientation and gender are complicated, aren't they? Gender identity is what's in our head. It's our manness or our womanness. It varies from culture to culture, and it's a subjective representation, not objective. You either align with it or you don't. And it's based only on the options that you know are available. And if you learn later that there are other options available, sometimes it can change. But not knowing an option exists doesn't mean it doesn't exist, and it can change. Gender expression is how we present ourselves. Most of us were shoved into some gender-conforming stereotype, and boys probably more than girls. And being a man kind of lacks some definition. A lot of us reject the stereotypical definition of what it means to be a man, but we can't quite figure out what the answer to that question is. And most of the time, it means not being feminine. If a person is artistic and refined in New York City, we might call them a metrosexual. In Wakefield, Nebraska, where I grew up, they'd be called sissy. Then there's the anatomical sex. It's what's in your underwear. It's what's on your birth certificate. It's how you're genetically programmed. It's boys' penises and girls' things. But it's really all more nuanced than that if we begin to talk about intersex, but we won't do that today. And the final thing then is romantic attraction, which is in our heart. And it's the magic in a relationship, and it can't be explained, it can't be ignored, and it can't be measured. It's what we desire, what we want, what we need in another person. It's the physical contact we need. It's the person that we want to have a relationship. So all these things explain the complexity of gender and sexuality. Well, why do we need these labels? And many people object to the labels because many of us were hurt by them. When we were called queer or sissy or any of those things as children, it really hurt. But these labels do help us, I think, understand our sexuality and how complicated. It also allows us to identify with a group. And that's what I was missing in Wakefield, Nebraska. That's why I felt so isolated and alone, because I had no group that I could identify with. Now experts generally agree that attraction is innate. Not everybody does, of course, but the experts tend to agree on that. And as Gary mentioned, one of the areas that I've been interested in is age gap relationships and the difference in ages that are 20, 40, 50 years apart. And I hear from, I've written about that, and not many people have written about it. So I hear from a lot of these guys, and we could spend an hour talking about that. But for these men, age is a central part of their sexual orientation. And they will say that it persists as they get older. But our attractions and our behaviors don't always agree, do they? Behavior is influenced by our circumstances. There was a study done, a good study done in a respected journal several years ago of about 10,000 blue-collar men in New York City. And 10% of the married men had had sex with a man in the preceding year. And 10% of the men who identified as heterosexual were having sex exclusively with men. So I often joke that there's more straight men having sex with men than there are gay men having sex with men. Well, Josie is my oldest granddaughter. And about a year and a half ago, she came out initially as bisexual and now identifies as lesbian. And she began to talk to me about the intersection of disability and being queer. And I thought that was a really strange marriage. But she talked about how both have experienced slurs, discrimination, all kinds of things. And in doing a little reading about it, one person with a disability said, it's neither tragic nor pitiful to be disabled, but an integral part of who we are. And isn't that the way we see our sexuality? You know, it's the same kind of expression. Well, this new book is dedicated to my brother Lefty, and I get the next slide here. Lefty is the one in the upper left corner there. He's 7 years older than I am. He was the kind of guy I wanted to be. He was smart. He was an athlete. He was popular. But he did all those things that I did, but did them in way better than I did them. Lefty belonged. I mean, he was one of the boys. When he was 16 years old, he was coming back from a baseball game, and the car went off of the road and went into a ditch. And his spinal cord was severed in the cervical area. He became a quadriplegic, and he was able to flex and extend his arms, but he had no use of his hand. And for the first 6 months of his this time, he was actually hospitalized in our local hospital with burr holes in his head that were attached to cables that were attached to weights to try and hold him motionless in bed. Well, of course, in that process of time, he developed horrible bed sores. And at the end of that, I mean, they expected him to die. Nobody really had much hope for that. And at the end of that time, he was sent to New York University Hospital and Rehab Center, which was a wonderful thing for him. And he learned that being disabled was just, as this other person said, is just part of who he was going to be. And he learned that he could go to a Dodgers baseball game. At the time, the Dodgers were in Brooklyn. And if you shit yourself, you shit yourself. I mean, you don't let that experience define your life. And so he was a wonderful man. So I'm going to tell you a little more about him. When Lefty was 23 and I had just turned 16 and gotten my driver's license, I occasionally took Lefty on a boys' night out to Sioux City, Iowa. He always asked me to take him to an adult bookstore at the end of the evening. He browsed the adult magazines of nude women. He pointed out his selections. I held them for him until he reached the clerk who required an adult to purchase them. Upon our return home, I hid the magazines in a now empty Mounds candy bar box. The Mounds candy bar box, some local merchant had given him a box of Mounds candy bars for Christmas. And they were on the shelf in his closet, and I'd go in, I'd say, "Lefty, do you want a candy bar?" He'd say, "No, but you can have one." So I'd usually have two. And I'm not sure he ever had one, but that's how the box got empty. When the two of us were home alone together, he would ask, "Lauren, would you bring me the box?" Then I left him alone to his fantasies. When he called me to return the box to the shelf, I looked through the magazines. I saw that he had caressed the naked women's photos by drawing lingerie on them with a magic marker. We never talked about it. It was our man-to-man secret and intimacy shared but unspoken. It was my payback to him for stealing all his candy bars. The essential characteristic of a man of honor is that he takes risks, faces others, and stares them down. When someone offered their hand for Lefty to shake, he stretched his hand out to meet theirs. He showed no embarrassment or shame about his shrunken and contracted hand. He grasped their hand with his emotion, if not with his physical strength, as if to say, "I'm a man among men." When I cared for Lefty's personal hygiene needs, he often had a powerfully erect young man's penis. As I was a pre-adolescent boy, it was the first time I'd ever seen anything like that. Paralyzed men get normal erections, fully capable of penetration, but they are only a reflex mediated through the spinal cord. The severed spinal cord cannot carry a sexual message to the brain. Paralyzed men can masturbate and sometimes ejaculate, but orgasms are in the brain, and ejaculation is in the sex organs. For Lefty, these were not connected. Numbness is a feeling quite like silence in a symphony. It intensifies feelings by its absence. So all of these things suggest to you why it's so complicated. Our sexuality is so complicated. It's not just what happens where we drop our load. It's a combination of what goes on in our brain, in our nervous system, in our hormone system, our vascular system. All these things are integrated. And then there's this big unknown thing called the mind, where all these unconscious processes also contribute. One of the things that I object to is a term, sexual performance. I always think that it makes it sound like we're expecting a standing ovation when we're done, you know. But it's in my mind, it's really sexual function. And good sexual function integrates physical intimacy, emotional intimacy, and it requires listening, and listening fearlessly to our partners. And I believe that old men learn how to have slow sex, and they have the best sex. But did we have to be as good as we were, or we thought we needed to be? When you're always good and trying to please others, you sacrifice agency over your own life. Other people begin to control it. Now, Bishop Johnson again said that the worst things, he talked about two boys who were saying, "What's the worst thing you've ever done?" And one of them responded, "If that's the worst thing you've ever done, I can't be your friend anymore." And many of us have experienced that. My three best friends, one of them a friend from the time I was 4 years old until I was, he was my best man at my wedding when I married my wife, and a couple of other good friends, absolutely rejected me when I came out to them. And that's what we all fear when we come out. But a lot of times when we're thinking about coming out, we magnify all the negatives and we minimize the positives. It's hard to imagine what that feeling of freedom that we have is like until you begin to experience it. My first experience with that was as going to a gay fathers group here in Des Moines. It was many years ago. And I walked into that group and saw this diverse group of men who were all fathers and all of them committed fathers. But I began to feel really connected and belonging in that group for the first time in my life. And it shattered all the stereotypes I had about what it meant to be gay. Well, old age comes up and time becomes urgent. We don't get many do-overs at this point, or at my point anyhow. And during that time, we've had hard stuff. We've all had hard stuff. And some people say that gay people have crisis competence because they've dealt with competence or crisis in their life. But when we're good boys like that, we believe that love was conditional, that we only could be loved if we were the good boys. And I'm not sure that unconditional love really exists. We want it, but the truth is none of us are very good at it. But we really must start by loving ourselves unconditionally. Too much of Biden on my mind, I guess. Can I have the next slide? So here's what I talked about. Labels are either useful or destructive. Sexuality is infinitely complex, and we need to love ourselves unconditionally. So I want one take-home message for you is to stop being afraid of getting old. I said old men make better lovers, and I believe that's the case. Because as you get old, you understand the complexity of sex. You realize that great sex doesn't require a world-class hard-on, and you don't have to be able to shoot cum over your shoulder. We have the freedom to be who we want to be. We have the freedom to love who we want to love. And it allows us to talk about the hard stuff. And talking about the hard stuff is what brings us closer together, and telling our stories is what changes people's minds. So that last one. And so who am I? I'm a cisgender, homoerotic, gay man. And I may have told you more than you wanted to know, but if you don't like it, fuck off. So I do have some pre-publication copies of my book available that I'll give to you, anybody who wants to be willing to review it for Amazon when it comes out in May. I've got 5 copies, so just see me afterwards. And I'll... Those are just some bookmarks that give you information about the book and the website and stuff. And take some for yourself. And if you want to take some for others, that's true. Go ahead and help yourself to as many as you want. And questions?
Yeah, questions. Any questions for Dr. Olson?
Yeah, call me Lauren. I'm comfortable with Lauren among friends.
Gay man, I think there are 2 terms we all know, dickheads and pigs. As in all men are pigs, and as in our gay friends, we are really dickheads.
I think, you know, of course, a lot of the words that, whether we're comfortable with them or not, can be used as slurs. And so dickhead might sound good to somebody. It might sound like a real... like word like queer or sissy or faggot or any of those other things, others. But a lot of, particularly I think older men are uncomfortable with the word queer and don't like it. I'm not sure I've answered your question yet.
The terminology ticket reference the brain.
Mm-hmm.
We all like to think that are somehow initiated up here.
Well, I presume, I think there are young men, and mostly young men, but a lot of other people who are driven by sexuality that is focused on insertion and ejaculation, and that's their definition of sex. You know, and it's very specific. And I see it, and I don't know that it's necessarily true of younger men than older men, but when people talk about sexuality, and men talk to me a lot about it, of course, and when they talk about it, that's where they're focused: getting an erection, ejaculating, getting their partner off, and then coming, and then starting all over again. And that they're constantly on a search for that. And I think a lot of that has to do with particularly like people who hang out on some of the porn sites. When we our sexual desire is based on opportunity and attraction. And when we're involved in that sort of focus, it's kind of a transcendental experience. You know, when you're scoping a website and watching cams and all that kind of stuff, your mind isn't thinking about whether your electric bill's paid, you know. And I think it's a kind of a numbing process for many people. I also think that for many, it's a escape from the loneliness they feel. That's another part of it. Anyone else? Yeah, Gary. Well, hopefully, yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, where it becomes part of the attractiveness of maybe an older man. It often has to do with us being able to explain ourselves better.
Mm-hmm.
And important to understand that that part of that, that's something that half people develop that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I came out at 40. And when I grew up, town of 1,000 in Northeast Nebraska, I didn't know anybody who was openly gay. In fact, I didn't know anybody who was openly gay until I was about 32. And then I met, and unfortunately that was not a very good experience. He was, well, that's a whole nother story too, but read the book. I didn't want to be like him. And he so fit that negative stereotype of what it meant to be gay that I assumed everybody who was gay was like that. It wasn't until I began to experience men, all kinds of men that were still men, but attracted to men, and began to see it as a normal process. But as I said earlier, just because we don't know it exists doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And so even in those years when I was growing up, there were gay people in cities, and but not in rural Nebraska. In fact, I went back for my 50th class reunion from medical school, and I asked some of the other classmates if there were gay bars in Omaha when we were in medical school. None of them knew. But if you review the history of gay life in Omaha, there were a lot of them, and there was a cruising area, and there was a whole lot. But at that time, we would have been thrown out of medical school if we had been caught in a gay bar. So it was a whole different kind of experience for us in those days. Rick.
I'm really interested in Jesus and John Wayne feel like that is a separate thing now, and that they don't want their young men are weak homosexuals. Mm-hmm. So the idea of Trump and cruelty and meanness and all of that seems to be blowback from this definition of gay being weak. And I find that kind of fascinating at the same time as before.
Yeah, I think you're right onto it. I think when many of us were growing up, anything that looked homosexual or gay or whatever was definitely thought of a weakness. And I corresponded with a lot of men from the Middle East, and that's still an issue for them because women are subordinated in that culture. And to be anything like a woman is weak. And if, for a lot of them, they might say, well, I like oral sex, but I never, never would have anal sex because that's too much like a woman. And then I'll tease them a little bit and say, you never think about it? And they say, well, sometimes, you know. But it's interesting because it very definitely, and that it plays out very definitely in that culture at this time in the Middle East. And I think the other side of that is that what we consider as strong men is now many people think of as toxic, you know, because it's all about winning and dominance and all of these kinds of many of the things that a lot of us reject. And still we struggle to define ourselves as men. And I think, you know, that's when I go back to Lefty, I think about that so much because he was weak and helpless in many ways, but in other ways he was very powerful. And I think the connection I have, well, that we have many connections with each other, he's deceased now, but it was the idea that this was just a problem he had. It was something he had to deal with, and it didn't affect his concept of himself as a man. And I think that's where we need to come to, is that we have all these things that we experience, but we're still men. We may define it in our own way, and that's what I talked about, unconditional acceptance of ourselves. We don't all have to be the same in the way that we act as men. Well, he's still one of the most remarkable men I ever knew. He went through a couple of years of rehabilitation, came home on a stretcher for a while, then went to Mayo Clinic. They put him in a wheelchair. He started working for a local food manufacturer doing some accounting work. When I started medical school, my sister said to him, why don't you go to college? Wayne State College was 10 miles away. So my mother would take him to Wayne in the morning and leave him there. And then go to work and then go back and get him. And students at Wayne State took him around the campus. And he ended up magna cum laude from there, became an accountant, had his own business, became mayor of my hometown for 20 years and married a sweetheart who became his caretaker and kind of let my mother off the hook. I think he's one of those guys, you know, like the double amputee who flew an airplane. And he traveled all over the United States. He went to Europe a couple times. He met the Queen Mother in England. I mean, he went down a raft in one of the Caribbean islands, and they had to tie him on the raft because he couldn't control himself. I was always in the stories about him. He has one little brother, you know. So I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. He was a hero. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
I'm curious. You've been at the podium a number of times, and now today you're seeing no expressions from us. I'm curious what your reaction as a presenter in the moment.
I can read everything about you, Brad.
Yeah.
but the honest answer is I don't like it. And doing the book and now going out on a book tour, a lot of this is going to be Zoom meetings, and it's just not the same. It's just not the same. And unlike many of you think, I don't read people's minds.
Thank you.
We so appreciate Dr. Olson. We're lucky to Lauren, and we're lucky to have him as a member of the club and as a very capable and insightful speaker. That concludes our meeting this month. Please do see Lauren if you want one of his books. Please continue fellowship on the way out the door. Stay warm, and we will see you back here in February. Thank you.